part of the Press Play Podcast Network.
Chapter 16, The Man in the Stadium. It's August 12th, 2003, and Juan Catalan wakes up from a dream that he was being abducted by aliens. It's a weird dream, but he wakes up nonetheless and he gets ready for the day. He and his girlfriend Alma drive to his job, his father's shop. It's any other day, or so he thought. He turns off the ignition, grabs the door handle, opens the door, and steps from the car. Something is off, but he can't quite place it. Something is more than off. Something is terribly wrong. But he's oblivious to the man stepping from the van just across from him. The man is wielding a gun, and he's pointing the gun at Juan. And within 30 seconds, he's looking at a slew of guns, all pointing towards him. One of the men grabs him and throws him to the ground. It's a moment before he registers he's being arrested. He looks up just barely and sees his father, the expression on his face which I imagine mirrored his own. A few days later, a detective arrives at Alma's house and presents her with the same information that Juan has already been made aware of. He's been arrested for the murder of 16-year-old Martha Puebla. Martha had previously testified at court a few months earlier on a murder case in which Juan's brother was a co-defendant. In court, Martha was asked to identify a shooter, but she had indicated that she was unaware of who the shooter was. Juan was sitting in the gallery that day, and he said after that day, he never thought of Martha again, until he was charged with her murder. From the Hyman blog and the Press Play Podcast Network, I'm J.D. Hyman. As a black man living here in America, I am living proof that while all men were created equal, not all men are equal. We're here to dig into the American political system, explore and unearth experiences from the human condition, and be a catalyst for some hard conversations that need to be had. Conversations that demand to be had. No matter what brought you here, I'm glad you came. Once again, my name is J.D. and this is the Hyman Podcast. Part 1. The Tape. Juan's cousin used to brag about a lawyer in which he worked as a filing clerk. Juan and his family enlisted the help of Todd Melnick, who at the time was a criminal defense attorney. At his arraignment, detectives testified that a witness came forward and identified the shooter as a man whose features were uncanny to those of Juan. While he was being questioned by detectives, they were certain he was the guy. Melnick deposed the detectives who maintained that their witness identified Juan via a photo lineup. Juan maintained his innocence. Melnick's next step was to see if he could piece together an alibi for Juan. The murder took place on May 12, 2003. Alma, Juan's girlfriend, remembered something. She remembered that Juan went to a Dodgers game that day. So Melnick thought if he could prove that Juan was at the game, he could get the case thrown out. According to Juan, he took his daughter, his cousin, and one of his friends. Juan was able to remember certain details about the game, including buying his daughter a card afterwards. According to the official police report, Martha was at her home and had come outside to talk to a few friends. It was just around 10 p.m. While she was outside conversing with her friends, some of the eyewitnesses noticed a Chevy Malibu drive around the block several times before stopping in front of Martha's house. The driver exited the vehicle and approached Martha. Martha recognized the driver, saying so much as, "Hey, it's Martha. You remember me." And the driver responded, "No, you don't." And just as quickly pulled a gun from his sweatshirt and then shot her point blank in the head. She is killed instantly. The primary witness drops his cell phone and runs for his life. When police finally catch up with the eyewitness, he agrees to sit with a sketch artist and a composite sketch is drawn. The case was assigned to Beth Silverman, deputy district attorney. She was known for never having lost a murder trial in her career, and what's more, her nickname was the Sniper, because she almost exclusively sought the death penalty. The case that Beth Silverman presented to the court was that Juan was present at his brother's preliminary hearing and was upset that Martha testified and wanted her dead because of it. And like her nickname suggested, she was pursuing the death penalty. Todd Melnick asked Alma to locate the Dodgers ticket, and then he contacted Sam Fernandez, Senior Vice President and General Counsel for the Los Angeles Dodgers. Sam took Melnick to Dodger Stadium, where they walked around, giving Melnick an opportunity to get a lay of the land. He found the seats where Juan was sitting. Melnick learned that the tickets that Juan had were bought from season ticket holders, and that the seats around where he was sitting were also held by season ticket holders. So Melnick reached out to as many of them as possible to see if any of them remembered seeing Juan and his family at the game. Person after person indicated that they didn't pay enough attention to their surroundings, that they noticed Juan or his family. After striking out, no pun intended, Melnick came across something else. He realized that there were cameras placed throughout the stadium that were used for Dodger Vision. This is the in-house filming that is used on the big screens throughout the stadium. Todd combed through the video, attempting to locate Juan. Meanwhile, Juan had been transferred to a Supermax prison where he was awaiting a hearing and subsequently a trial. He was starting to feel framed. Melnick eventually found Juan, but the resolution was so low that the video was virtually unusable. Melnick broke the news to Juan that he found him on camera, but that the video resolution was too low to use in court. And it was at that moment that another memory was triggered for Juan. He remembered a film crew. He remembered that something was being filmed at the stadium. He remembered seeing security and some man walking up and down the aisle during the different tapes. Now Melnick had a new lead to chase down. He reached back out to Sam Fernandez, who brought him back out to Dodger Stadium, and together they went to the media relations office. The associate pulled out a calendar book and flipped through the pages. Melnick noticed that most of the pages were blank, but when they got to May 12, there was an entry. He noted the name of a production company, and there was a phone number. Melnick didn't recognize the name of the production company, but he called the number anyways, and to his surprise, someone answered, "This is HBO." Todd was obviously shocked. The person who answered was Tim Gibbons, a producer with HBO. Gibbons, after hearing this fantastical story, tells Melnick that as a company, they don't release pre-production footage and that he would have to wait until it airs. Melnick is persistent. His client's future depends on it. After some thought, Gibbons decided to get someone else involved, and that someone else happened to be Larry David, the creator of Seinfeld. Melnick was wholly unaware of who Larry David was, but they agreed to let Melnick come down and check out the video on site. They were filming an episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm. The cast of the episode, actors Larry David and Kim Whitley, to name a few, didn't even know where the cameras were. Because it was Dodger Stadium, the areas they were allowed to film were completely arbitrary. The camera operators were placed on the other side of the stadium and used telephoto lenses to shoot the scenes. Melnick was taken to an editing bay, and a production assistant began playing through the tapes. As told by Juan, during the game, he at one point left his seat to get some concessions. Melnick's fear was that he was at the concession stand while they were filming. Things were getting tense in the editing bay as one tape was replaced with another. And as they neared the end of the tapes, Melnick's fears were starting to become a reality. Something Juan told him was starting to eat at him. Juan remembers a member of the production crew holding him back at the top of the aisle. The production crew was told not to prevent anyone from returning to their seats, but asked that they not walk down the aisle if they didn't want to be on film. But the PA remembers things differently. He wasn't sure if he was letting people up and down the aisle or not. Melnick, Gibbons, a PA, and Larry David sat glued to the screen. Melnick was grasping at straws. What kind of bad luck does a person have to be sitting in the very section where a TV crew is filming in high definition, is accused of murder, and the one thing that can exonerate him, he misses because he wanted popcorn? And then it happened. Just as Larry David made his way up the aisle, closing out the scene, Juan and his daughter crossed into the frame. He's wearing a white jersey. It's Kevin Brown's jersey, the name Brown and the number 27 emblazoned on the back. He walks into his row, turns to ensure his daughter is behind him, his right hand carrying food, his left clasping his daughter's tiny hand, his profile shown in full view. The editing bay that was once quiet is now loud. Melnick is screaming for joy. Before the end of the tape, Juan is seen two more times. According to the timestamps, he is first seen at 8:55 p.m. and again at 9:15 p.m. Melnick was sure he'd done it. He cracked the case. But then another reality sets in. The murder takes place nearly 45 minutes later at 10:32 p.m. And that presents another problem. More on this after the break.
What's up, everyone? Chase Smith here, host of the Chase Smith Podcast. And my podcast reflects who I am. My hobbies, my interests, my passions, my curiosities, my careers, my questions, and my family. I'll spend time talking about all types of sports, movies, TV shows, trending news stories, and other cultural events, and even faith. This is who I am, and I hope I can get to know you as well. Join me on the Chase Smith Podcast, and let's have some thought-provoking conversations, only on the Press Play Podcast Network.
Hello, Brooks here with the Books with Brooks monthly book club podcast. Here's how Books with Brooks works. We read one book a month and then we talk about it. Classics like Stephen King's The Shining, debut novels like We Are the Brennans by Tracy Lang, and tons of other compelling, life-changing stories, one book and one month at a time. So come read along with us and then listen in.
This episode of the Hyman Podcast is brought to you by presenting sponsor Uproar Coaching. Check it out.
Uproar Coaching. Let me guess, you're ready to get serious about your goals and you're looking for accountability support, but you don't have the time or the tolerance for the chit chat. You're busy balancing work and life and home and all that other crap, and your to-do list isn't getting any shorter. You've been talking about making that career leap, finishing that creative project, kicking that bad habit, but you simply don't have the time and energy to invest in yourself. Listen, Uproar Coaching gets you. You are busy. What if I told you can get maximum accountability with minimal commitment? Productivity without punishment. Uproar Coaching's Busy Bitch program brings you all of the good stuff you'd get from a weekly hour-long coach session, minus the conversation. Here's how it works. Each Friday morning for 5 weeks, you'll receive an email with three prompt questions. Take 10 minutes to answer those questions. That's it. By Monday, midday, you'll receive a personal reply offering support and challenging those limitations you're putting on yourself. This is productivity supercharged. And let me tell you, once you meet Carrie, you're going to want her to speak positivity and motivate you to accomplish your goals. She's authentic, enthusiastic, and genuine. She's the real deal. So go to UproarCoaching.com today, click on Work With Me, and find the Busy Bitch program. Listeners receive 10% off her Busy Bitch program by using promo code P3 at checkout. Again, visit UproarCoaching.com today to learn more.
Part 2, A Bleeding Diathesis. By his own admission, Juan is dropping off his cousin at his cousin's house on the same street as where the murder took place, not even 150 yards away from the crime scene. Melnick informs Juan that the prosecution will contend he left the game early and that in order to win this case, he had to place him at the game even longer. So they go back to the drawing board. Melnick wants to know everything Juan did post-game but before he drops his cousin off. He informs Melnick of a call he had with Alma after the game. Speaking with Alma, Melnick learned she called Juan at around 10:10 p.m. to see when he was getting home. Melnick thinks he can make a case with the cell phone and the cell phone tower pings. So he contacts Juan's cell carrier, Nextel. Tasha Box, a Nextel employee, is assigned the case and works with Todd to help decipher the cell tower data. Tasha notes that the cell tower Juan used was across the street from Dodger Stadium. She also notes that the radius for this particular tower is 1 mile, which meant Juan was still at Dodger Stadium until at least 10:12 p.m. Judge Leslie Dunn was assigned the case and knew the prosecutor was seeking the death penalty. At the preliminary hearing, Judge Dunn's task is to decide if the evidence is sufficient to bring the case to trial or if the case should be dismissed. She recesses and agrees to take the interrogation tapes home to listen to them. She listens to them ad nauseum. She made her children listen to the tapes. She had two incredible things to weigh: the potential innocence of a man falsely accused and justice for Martha Puebla, who was shot and killed in cold blood. At the next hearing, Martha's family is present in the gallery. Todd lays out his case. He has the Dodgers tickets, the video from the TV show, and the cell phone towers. Beth Silverman lays out her case, a credible witness with no motive to lie and a composite drawing with an uncanny likeness to one Juan Catalan. As both sides conclude, Judge Dunn carefully weighs the facts she's presented with. She weighs the conversations from the interrogation. She weighs the family's grief. Ultimately, she decided that while the witness has no motive to lie and wants to be credible, he witnessed a crime on a darkened residential street under obvious traumatic circumstances. She ruled that the evidence presented by the prosecutor was not sufficient to go to trial. And just like that, Juan was a free man. It was later determined that the detectives in this case were dishonest and attempted to incriminate Juan under predatory pretenses. They admitted that they asked Juan questions in an attempt to obtain an incriminating response. They also admitted that they tried to trick him into incriminating himself by showing him a photo lineup where his photo was circled. As a result, they were both removed from working homicide cases. The FBI later learned that four other men were responsible for Martha's murder. Martha had learned that members of a gang had committed several crimes and was working with the police to see that they be arrested. When the gang learned she was working with the police, they had her executed. The same detectives that acted maliciously in trying to incriminate Juan had previously violated Martha's constitutional rights when they, in an attempt to incriminate a known gang member, let slip that Martha was helping the police. Martha's family was alerted of this and was told it was best if she was taken into witness protection. Her family declined this protection, and as a result, when they attempted to sue the LAPD, they were found to be 80% responsible for her death and were awarded $1 in damages. Juan, a Latino man from the wrong side of the tracks, was nearly put on death row all because of who he is. A few run-ins with the law and he had become a scapegoat. A prosecutor's hubris, a detective's lack of integrity, and a drawing was all it took to create the perfect storm, a recipe for systemic failure. The makings of a wrongful incarceration. Juan later sued the city of Los Angeles as well as the Los Angeles Police Department, and as a result was awarded $320,000 in a settlement. The men responsible for Martha's murder eventually accepted plea deals for life in prison without parole in order to avoid the death penalty. But unfortunately, the story doesn't end there, because Juan isn't the first victim of something like this. For his part, Juan only spent 6 months in jail. But when you're in jail for a crime you didn't commit, 6 months is a lifetime. Juan, like Lydell Grant, stayed strong. He believed in his innocence. He believed in an unjust justice system. He believed that despite the brokenness of this system, the truth would prevail. If only that were the case for everyone in such a situation, but unfortunately, the system doesn't work that way. Sometimes the system fails partway through. Sometimes it fails completely, and when that happens, it can feel like no force on this earth can make things right. We can't always rely on good fortune and luck to save ourselves. When it comes down to it, we need real change to adjust a system that hasn't had an overhaul in a lifetime, and we need it now. We oftentimes take our freedom for granted. And in the absence of a bleeding diathesis, we don't always see when the bad thing is coming our way until it's too late. And when the bad things come, they usually bring friends. But I suppose, in one respect or another, so do the good things. My name is J.D. Hyman. This is the Hyman Podcast. I'll see you next time. The Hyman Podcast was written, edited, and produced by myself. Share with guests Whitney Hall and Mary Louise Layton co-produce and research. Cover art and branding by Kevin Aki. The theme music was composed and produced by Jim Yosef with additional music license from Epidemic Sound. The Hyman Podcast is a production of the Press Play Podcast Network. Press Play is staffed by Chase Smith, our CEO and fearless leader. I serve as Chief Operating Officer, and Brooks May is the Chief Creative Officer. To learn more about the network, sponsorships, guest appearances, or if you're interested in launching your own podcast on our network, visit us on the web at www.pressplaypodcast.com. To learn more about this podcast, our mission and vision, or for sponsorship information, please visit us on the web at www.jdhyman.com.